afternoon and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with Padre Greedy and myself, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is an enlightenment-friendly chat show about science, rationalism, humanism and the left. And it's that last subject we'll be turning to tonight with our guest making a very welcome return to Little Atoms, the journalist Nick Cohen. Padre.
Nick Cohen is a columnist for The Observer and The New Statesman and The Evening Standard, and, as Neil said, is the author of What's Left. So, for anyone who hasn't seen a newspaper or blog or television programme in the past few weeks, tell us quickly what the book's about.
To sum it up, it's about why, if heaven forfend, an Islamist bomb was go off in London tonight, killing hundreds of people, you could guarantee that liberal and left-wing commentators will be all over the media blaming Tony Blair or British foreign policy and averting their eyes from an ideology that's psychopathic, totalitarian, misogynist, homophobic and racist. Why, in other words, are people who consider themselves liberals, consider themselves leftists, going along with the movements and ideas of the ultra-right, of fascistic right, of ideas that are against everything they represent, people who will scream their heads off at their workplace if there's a smallest sexist or racist remark? Why are they going along with movements which are ultra-misogynist, ultra-racist?
Now, a lot of the commentary recently has been from the liberal anti-war left has seemed to present it as specifically an apology for the Iraq War. Is that true? Does that hold up?
Well, no. I mean, look. The liberal intelligentsia in London, the better outside London, liberal intelligentsia in London are very unused to being criticised on their on principle grounds. Mm-hmm. They're used to being wrong. They're wrong about quite a lot of things, but they want to feel good when they're wrong. Mm-hmm. They're not used to having their principles criticised, and so they lash out in the most unscrupulous fashion. You've got a copy there, there are two chapters on the Second Iraq War, both of which begin with accounts of how the protesters had good points at the time against the war, how much of what they said, even though they didn't know about Iraq, turned out to be absolutely spot on and absolutely true. But then there's a but. And the but is the reason for this book, is why is it that they can't support people in Iraq who've had 35 years of the most revolting regime, a regime that stepped out of liberal nightmare and committed every crime a liberal should be against, up to including genocide? Why can't they support people who want something better when those same people are being blown apart by Al-Qaeda and the Ba'ath Party, which once again represents everything they're meant to be against? So, and they, you know, they sound very principled when they talk, but, you know, equally, they can seem like very comfortable white people who don't want to make a commitment, and it's driven them into a state of fury. I mean, some of the comments I've had on my book, it's like, either they haven't read it, or I know in some cases they have read it, but they find it politic for social and cultural reasons to write as if they haven't.
But do you think they see themselves reflected in the book and clearly
yeah.
don't like it?
Yeah, you see, if I'd just done a book about the far left, about how it's flipping over to the far right, the Islamist far right, they'd probably been all right with that. But then there's not much, although it's always worth examining the far left, because a lot of ideas from the far left go mainstream. It would be sort of like a Louis Farou, mm-hmm. the guy with the glasses, who, you know, goes around cults and things like that. It would have been like that. The point of the book is how ideas that begin in very obscure corners, as all ideas do, all ideas have to begin somewhere. Everything you and I take for granted, for good and ill, once began with small groups of people. How ideas that begin in the wreckage of the far left, once socialism is gone, and in postmodernism, the postmodern academy, very, very morally dubious ideas, have saturated the liberal mainstream. So that's I think that's their real reason for objecting. And they're all holding their hands up and saying, no, we're nice, sane, reasonable, educated people. And they're not accepting they've got one big thing very badly wrong that allowed themselves to be unable to confront movements and regimes of the far right.
But ironically, this is another criticism that's been made, that you are perhaps dealing with the traits of extremely small groups that we do. I mean, we get accused of it ourselves, and certainly Harry's Place, for instance, often gets accused of being obsessed with the Socialist Workers' Party when nobody really cares. But I mean, as you've just said, first of all, first of all, they do shed a light on the trends of the sort of wider left, but also it is also quite good fun as well to attack this group. So perhaps you could let's dive into one, and perhaps you could tell our listeners a little bit about the story of Gerry Healy and the Workers' Revolutionary Party.
Yeah, first of all, you say it's good fun to do this. It's always done. BBC Four did a series called Lefties,
indeed,
and it was disgraceful. It was absolutely disgraceful. They started off with the Leninists of the 70s in the street in Brixton and said as a joke, oh, they're members of the Workers' Revolutionary Party and the International Marxist Group. At no point does the BBC say the International Marxist Group ever came to power, the gutters were bubbled with blood, and the Workers' Revolutionary Party was led by Gerry Healy, who you mentioned, who was a rapist, a sociopath, and... in the pay of Saddam Hussein, and spied on Iraqi exiles in Britain. Because they're nice middle-class people doing the same sort of nice middle-class people who work for the BBC. You could never imagine the BBC doing a programme about, hey, wasn't it great when these guys were in the National Front in 1974? I do it because this is a good story, but also because the argument of this book is that liberal and left-wing people are going along and making excuses for Islamist movements of the far right. And isn't this novel? I mean, some conservative critics don't quite get that. Conservative critics, and I've had good reviews from conservative critics, I'm not complaining. You know, if you want the highly dubious pleasure of having a writer as your loyal friend for life and following you around like a dog, just give him or her a good review. We'll love you forever and haunt you for your dying days. They say, oh no, please go away. But they don't quite get it. They say, well, look, in the 20th century, left-wing people supported communism and far, far more turned a blind eye to communism, what's new? You have to come from the left to realise, I understand why people did this. I come from a very left-wing family. I understand it. Not right, but I understand it, because it's all still the left. Now, people are going along with the ultra-right. And so I looked back in history for other times when it's happened, nothing like on this scale. And the 70s, Healy and his corrupt relationship with Saddam was one of them. You see, one of the problems of writing a book about current affairs is people expect a political pamphlet with all things neatly laid out. This is a book. It's not a political programme. You ought to be able to read it like you read a novel. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at the psychology of betrayal, the psychology of how do people who are left-wing, who throw fascists around as an insult to everyone from their dad telling them to get a haircut to a policeman telling them to move along to demo, when confronted with actual fascists, how they justify themselves, how they go over to their side. Now, in some ways, the Leninist sects of the 70s are, it's pretty easy. They I call them Leninists, that's what they are, but they followed Leon Trotsky. Now, Trotskyists had a huge problem in the 20th century in that they couldn't commit to democracy because they wanted to overthrow it, establish their own totalitarian state, but they couldn't go along with communism either, because nearly all the communist regimes, and even the Euro-communists then, owed something to Stalin, who was Trotsky's enemy and killer in the end. So they're left with, they're in a position like the 21st century left after communism has gone. All they can do is they turn to radical right movements like Saddam Hussein's Iraq. So that's, they're interesting as a precursor of Galloway and all of that. I then go back to the 30s, and that's far more psychologically interesting, what happens in the 30s when war comes, height of the Blitz here in London, and an awful lot of left-wing people think, Jesus Christ, we've got a choice, we either have to support Britain or we have to support Hitler. And a minority, but not just the communists who were in bed with Hitler anyway because of the Hitler-Stalin pact, and the pacifists who had to pretend Hitler wasn't so bad, but lots of fellow travellers, celebrities, vicars, actors, the type of people you get all over the Independent, were in effect campaigning against the British government and ignoring Hitler completely, organising strikes, saying that the real enemy is Churchill and the Labour Party in Whitehall, not Hitler. And the psychology of that is very, very interesting and extremely contemporary. You know, you get people like Virginia Woolf saying, well, Hitler's bad because he's a fascist, but look, the Church of England won't allow women priests. That's fascist too. She can't see the difference. And of course, if you call everyone a fascist, if you say, well, Al-Qaeda's bad, but George Bush, his fundamentalism is just as bad, you can't fight the real thing.
Sure,
you throw it all around. Now that's very modern. So you know, I do go back into the past to look at how this happens. There's another example of a lot of people, including to their terrible mistake, the Iranian socialists, who, when the Ayatollah Khomeini takes power, you know, they say, well, any revolution is better than none. We'll go along with this. And of course, the first thing Khomeini does, as any Islamist movement does, is destroy the socialist movement, kill them, torture them, throw them into prison. So, you know, how left-wing people do that helps explain, I think, the moral crisis of today.
So, I mean, you mentioned Khomeini doing that, and there's at the moment there's this phenomenon of within the Stop the War coalition, there's a formal alliance between the Socialist Workers' Party and the Muslim Brotherhood.
And Jamaat-e Islami as well. I mean, Jamaat-e Islami is actually the main... It's basically the South Asia version of the Brotherhood. But that's Bangladesh, and most of the votes come from Bengalis most of Muslim votes, for respect, come from Bengalis.
Yeah. Later in the programme, I want to get into the ideas of why the sort of middle-class Marxist intellectuals have basically abandoned the working classes. But if we can talk about this subject without mentioning that now, what do you think the Socialist Workers' Party have got to gain from this alliance? Because as you've said, you know, clearly, if these guys got in charge, they would be the first up against the wall.
One of the big things this book deals with, the big facts, which has taken me a long time to accept, is that socialism, which defines what it means to be left-wing, democratic or totalitarian, for 100 years, at least 100 years, from 1880s to the 1980s, possibly even going back to the 1860s, really. That's just gone. That's dead. It may come back again in some different form. I hope it does in some ways. But at the moment, there is no party anywhere in any developed country that is proposing even modestly to nationalise the banks, for instance.
Yeah.
Or to take over industry. Or have workers' control. It's just gone. Now, what happens to people, and it's not just a few deracinated and confused people in the SWP, it's quite a lot of people in the academy outside want something else, because a world without an alternative is a disenchanted place, and people like the law, the seduction of violence, the seduction of unreason, the idea that, well, there are other forces out there, and if you don't behave, Tony Blair, if you don't behave and do what we say, they'll attack you. But where are they going to turn to it? All they've got left, really, are the movements of the extreme right. I mean, Martin Kettle, the Guardian, wrote a very complimentary piece about my book and said something far better than I said. He said that it's very unclear if the left has survived the 20th century, but the far right most certainly has. And so if you're someone who has the parochialism of mind to just hate your own system, and God knows there's enough to hate in this, I'm not saying you shouldn't criticise, but if you've got that parochialism and you want an alternative, where else are you going to turn to but to Islamism? You know, actually, a version of Islamism can sound very, very like what the Trots want. I mean, they hate Americans. Ooh, we do too. They hate globalisation. Oh yeah, we're dead against that. And actually, you know what? They're going out there and they're killing Americans. Now, nowhere in the world are there Marxist revolutionaries who are willing to fight and kill and die for Marxism. But there are these people who, if you look at it in a certain light, you can see, well, they're prepared to do it. And all you have to forget about is their misogyny, their homophobia, their intolerance of free thought. Well, that wouldn't bother Marxists. And their belief that all the human race needs to know is from some 7th century holy book. So you can see why they have to do this. Beyond the provocation.
And the hatred of Marxism as well, of course.
Of course they hate socialists, yeah. Well, they always kill them. I mean, Fred Halliday wrote a very good piece for Open Democracy. Because, so look, what the movements do, it's not just Khomeini kills the left. You know, Hamas does. You know, where's the Saudi Arabian left? You know, yeah. Where's the, you know, the Taliban was dedicated to overthrowing a communist government. It was actually quite a good government. You know, what do you think you're doing in line with people? But they are such lost souls. And all they've got left is their hatred now. They haven't got a political programme at all. But I then go on to say, because I'm constantly trying to move out from the fringe to the mainstream, is the absence of a political programme is hugely important. And in a way no one noticed when socialism died, a great benefit to people who call themselves left-wing, because you don't have to stand for anything beyond a dislike of what your own country does and what America does. And God knows, you know, Britain and America will do stupid and unjust things at times. And in any case, in a lopsided world where America's the only superpower, there's an instinctive anti-Americanism, because the world just feels out of joint. And so, but not having a program, look at Chomsky. Chomsky doesn't actually believe in anything. Yeah, it'd be impossible for a young politician to say, I want to take power and impose a Chomskyan program. There is no such thing. And that makes it very easy for the consumer society. All you have to do is be against Bush and Blair. You don't have to commit to anything. You most certainly, and this is the most shameful side of what's happening, you don't have to commit to people in the poor world who share your values. Because they're not committing to people in Iraq who call themselves socialists, or Iran who call themselves feminists. So that's, in one sense, people can be very angry, but in another sense, they can just be fat white Westerners, you know, not wanting to help other people. And that is a huge advantage. See, if I was on this show 40 years ago and I was a socialist, I might be saying things that you and Neil would be agreeing with. And then I'll have to say, because I'm a socialist, but also, you know, I want to nationalise everything, impose penal rates of taxation. You might think, well, we don't want this, you know. And so, but now I don't. Now they don't.
Yeah.
And that sort of leftism without a practical left is very, very useful as a brand, as of a way of getting people to support them.
But there's this. You quote John Lloyd here writing about this and saying that these people are idealists, and because they don't have a political program, it's easier because you can't, you know, like the Green movement or whatever.
To be fair to the Greens stand for election. They're a Green party across Europe. They put a program. That's more about the anti-globalisation movement. But it's more. I'm more interested in the consumerism of all of this. You know, the typical, I don't know, BBC producer, writer on papers I write for, is almost like an angry customer going into a shop and saying, and not thinking for a moment, I'm a consumer, I don't have to think about the hard day the shop girl's had. Don't give me my sob stories. And if she says, and not expecting to be asked, well, you say this good's faulty, how would you repair it? Yeah, no consumer would expect that. And not thinking he or she owes any loyalty to anyone. Thinking, you know, I can switch from Apple to Microsoft like that. Why should I owe any loyalty to anyone? It's very consumerist what's going on.
As he's put in the book, socialists without comrades.
Yeah, yeah, leftists without left.
Yes.
Of course, you know, serious politics, from whatever point of view, is hard, and principled politics means you've got to, you know, slog round meetings, you've got to work out a programme, and then get the public, or a majority of the public, to accept it. See, they don't have to do any of that. And so I always remember, I mean, they're terribly nice people, but the richest friends of mine invited me and my wife to stay in their villa on the Riviera. I'm not knocking it, you know, at all. But, and these people are filthy rich, and they had John Pilger and Noam Chomsky on their bookshelves. And I thought, of course you do. Of course you do. They're no threat to you. Of course you do. How are they a threat to you? You can just have a little frill of radical chic and a little frill of anti-Americanism, and that's fine, you know.
Getting back to the point you made in Martin Kettle's comment in your book about socialism died at the end of the 20th century, but the far right lives on. Do you think there's a failure of people to recognise that the far right does live on? I mean, people enter into this lazy equivocation between George Bush and Saddam Hussein or the Ayatollah Khamenei? Do they so consciously, do they really think that fascism lives?
Well, Western far-right movements, BNP, yeah. National Front, Front National in France, people oppose, and rightly so, in a way that manner that will be recognisable to 21st century left. We then come to the sort of next big thing in the book, which is called multiculturalism in Britain. Actually, all society is multicultural. There's nothing wrong with multiculturalism. It's an extreme form of multiculturalism, identity politics, which I discuss, and God help me, it was a pain to read. I went through the postmodern philosophers. I mean, one good reason to buy this book, if any of your listeners haven't bought it, is I've done your reading for you. I've actually read Foucault and Derrida and Judith Butler and tried to translate them into English, And, you know, you've only got one life. There is no God. It's a rationalist program. We can say that. You don't have to read some of the worst prose ever written. But, you know, you get the idea coming out there. And that, again, is to do with their desperation after the death of socialism. They start turning around the world, and the postmodern idea is you can't unequivocally criticise other cultures. It's wrong on all kinds of levels. It's wrong on the idea that other cultures are sealed boxes without their own struggles in, and that they don't change. But it's also that it's wrong in the sense of it makes a nonsense of your principles. If you're confronted with the usually unelected leader of some community or religious group saying, I'm sorry, my culture demands the subordination of women and homosexuals, Western liberals are tripped up by the thought that it's racist to oppose sexists, that it's racist to oppose, oppose homophobes. But then, of course, they get themselves get into a kind of racism that the emancipation of women is okay for white-skinned women in London, but not for brown-skinned women in Kabul. Or, to make it a bit closer to home, it's okay for white-skinned women in Richmond, but not for brown-skinned women in Bethnal Green and Bow. And this is having a massively debilitating effect, and is allowing extreme groups to flourish. But that is a very big factor in the inability to... One thing I want to do is to politicise ethnic politics. You know, people ought to be able to say, the Muslim Brotherhood is a far-right-wing organisation.
Yeah.
Which it is. You know, you only have to look at the Hamas Charter. Large chunks of it could have been written by Adolf Hitler. Yeah, but people are very reluctant to say that. And I get people, yeah, quitching at meetings as soon as I start saying that. But then you end up in the absurd position of like Channel 4, will go out and find the most far right Muslim group, put them on as a spokesman for the Muslims.
Yeah.
But they'll never put on Nick Griffin of the BNP as a spokesman for the whites. And if they did, all hell would break loose. You know, they can't extend politics. So a lot of far right politics is concealed by the inability of reluctance and a kind of wishy-washy, mimsy political correctness to use words plainly. And again, of course, what happens then? Because actually, there is no such thing as the Muslims.
No.
You know, this is a civil war going on within Islam. And again, liberals take the wrong side. They can't, even they're not taking the wrong side, they can't offer support to those who share their ideals.
Should we take the opportunity to pause for a song right now? This is Spears and Bowden, and it's Prickly-Eyed Bush.
That pricks my heart for sore. If ever I get out of this prickly-eyed bush, then I never will get in it anymore. Oh, hangman, stay your hand. Stay it for a while, for I think I see my sister coming over yonder stile. Oh, sister, have you brought me gold or silver to set me free, or to save my body from the cold, cold ground and my neck from the gallows tree? Oh, no, I have not brought you gold. Silver to set you free, for to save your body from the cold, cold ground and your neck from the gallows tree. Oh, the prickly-eyed bush that pricks my heart for sore. Oh, and if ever I get out in this prickly-eyed bush, then I never will get in it anymore. Stay it for a while, for I think I see my mother coming over yonder stile. Oh, mother, have you brought me gold? Silver to set me free, or to save my body from the cold, cold ground and my neck from the brought you gold. Silver to set you free, or to save your body from the cold, cold ground and you make from the gallows tree. Oh, the pickle I push, it pricks my heart for sore. Oh, and if ever I get out of this pickle I push, then I never will get in it anymore. Stay for a while, for I think I see my own true love coming over yonder stile. Oh, true love, have you brought me gold? Silver to set me free, or to save my body from the cold, cold ground and my neck from the gallows tree. Oh, yes, I have brought you gold. Oh, silver to set you free, for to save your body from the cold, cold ground and your neck from the gallows tree. Oh, the pickle I push, makes my heart full sore. Oh, now that I'm out of this pickle I bush, then I never will get in it anymore. Oh, and now that I'm out of this pickle I bush, then I never will get in it anymore.
Welcome back. That was Spears and Bowden, Prickly Bush. You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Neil Denny. I'm here with Padraig Greedy, and we're talking to Nick Cohen about his book, What's Left.
So, welcome back. Nick, we talked a good bit in the first half about how the left in this country has abandoned its, or even the notion of having comrades in other countries. There's quite a bit in your book about the disappointment of the liberal left in this country with what should be its own constituency, the working class.
Yeah, it's something I work very hard to try and pin down. Because I'm talking about the liberal intelligentsia,
yeah,
my type of people. There is a disillusion with democracy among them. You know, you, as every dinner party, you hear every half-baked political theorist just saying, oh, all the parties are the same, democracy is pointless, it's all a sham, all a charade. And I this matters in a way to their attitudes towards foreign totalitarianism. You know, if you are disillusioned with democracy at home, you're not going to support Democrats abroad. And that has a lot to do with liberal middle class attitudes towards the working class. Now remember, it wasn't just Marxists who thought that the working class was the class of the future, to use the language of the early 20th century. You know, Fabian socialists, social democrats, all thought the working class was going to bring them their ideas to power. And liberal intellectuals themselves, even if they weren't part of social democratic or socialist movements, like to pretend that they're speaking for the people, the oppressed, the poor, the outsiders, the marginal. And often they do. And that relationship with the working class has just broken down. It's almost as if the working class is being punished. I quote a wonderful chap who wrote a book on the white working class.
Isn't it?
Wonderful.
Book.
Oh, you are excellent. Yes. Anyway, Michael came up with his wonderful line of the multicultural society needed its common enemy. And it turned out to be the class which had been the focus of utopian fantasy for previous generations of middle class leftists. And Julie Birchall says the white working class is the only group it is politically correct to allow to disparage. And that sounds extreme. And I read her writing that. But then you just look around. It's partly because for good reasons, for very good reasons, and they've done a lot of good. Women's movement, gay movements, anti-racist campaigns have transferred the focus of a lot of politics, and they've won all their legal battles. But then out of that came the view that the most sexist, the most racist, the most homophobic person was a white working class man. Now, previously, only 40 years previously, the white working class man was, you know, muscular, shirt sleeves rolled up, going on with the socialist paradise in utopian thought. Now he's the embodiment of everything that's wrong and rotten. Now, I don't want to knock Will Self at all, because he's a very fine novelist, but I did notice in his latest novel, it's about how a sort of terrible taxi driver keeps his dreadful diary full of hatred of women, and then there's a catastrophe, and then a sort of peasant society builds on the ruins, and they find this diary, and that's their guide, and they then build a terrible misogynist society. Now, it's just interesting that he chooses that. I mean, whereas 40 years ago, if you wanted to present the ultimate villain would have been upper class. The plutocrat with the big hat, the big cigar, liking J.B. Priestley's plays, having his way with a factory girl and leaving her pregnant. And the ordinary people were either put upon all the forces for good. Now it's the ordinary people who exemplify the worst. And of course, this has given a huge opportunity to backlash conservative policies. We haven't really noticed this in Britain because New Labour has been so good at providing its own backlash against the left. But in George Bush's America, I'm immensely impressed by an American writer, left-wing writer called Thomas Frank, who's absolutely a great writer. Now, Tom has never achieved the global status of his contemporaries, Chomsky, Moore, people like that, because he's a proper intellectual who asks hard questions. And Tom comes from Kansas, and Kansas was once the most radical state in the Union. Yeah, it was so against slavery, it didn't wait for the rest of the country, it started the Civil War all by itself. In the 1890s and through to the 30s, it was the centre of populism, and populism then was anti-capitalist, against the railroad bosses, the bankers out on the East Coast are grinding small farmers into the ground. And Tom says, well, there's a populist movement there now, but it's against the liberal elites on the coast. And it's so strong, and it's genuine working class militants organising, it's so strong that George W. Bush didn't even need to campaign in Kansas. Now, that just sounds like the normal standard middle class intellectual just saying, oh, the masses are stupid, they're fooled by the media, Ross Limbaugh and all of that. But Tom doesn't just go along with that, and that's why he's not nowhere near as popular, but he's a far better writer, is he says a lot of what the way the liberal middle class operates now is anti-democratic. And his classic example of that is Roe v. Wade, the banning of abortion in America. It's done by the Supreme Court. Now, if the battle had been fought in state legislatures in the Senate, women's rights would have won. They've won everywhere else in the world. They would have won. But instead of going in for the long haul, instead of trusting democracy, it's handed down from above. And however you vote, you can't stop it. And Tom says this cements the picture of the liberal elite that's very, very suspicious of democracy, very, very suspicious of its fellow citizens. And you can see that in Europe too. There are far too many laws now restricting freedom of speech. There's far too much willingness to reach for the lawyers and say we want unelected judges to, in effect, make up the laws they go along rather than Parliament. And that, to me, shows a fear of and a lack of confidence in the open arguments and free elections of liberal democracy. Shows they're frightened of it. And it also shows to me that liberal intelligentsia, whose ideas dominated the 20th century, have this fantasy of going back to 1907 and explaining some Islington intellectuals of the day, what the future will look like. And everything apart from some form of collective ownership on their wish list, we've got. and things they haven't even thought about, we've got. But I don't feel that there's a lot of changes in society. I don't feel the liberal intelligence. I think it's subliminally very nervous, very unsure of its status. You know, nowadays governments, instead of, you know, in the 1940s, if you were running the departments of health or social security, it wouldn't be called social security in those days, you would talk to intellectuals from the LSE. Now governments are turning to businesses to provide ideas of how to manage society. And the status of the liberal intellectual is becoming far more marginal. And that again makes them uneasy, because their status is getting uneasy about democracy. It's, you know, I didn't feel I could write this book without at least having a stab at all of that, without at least talking about class, because, you know, funny way, you can go to endless debates on the left and no one ever bloody does, you know, I mean, but you think to be left-wing is to be, in some sense, engaged in some form of class politics.
Well, it's, you've obviously mentioned the gains that have been got by the left, you know, the fight against racism, against sexism, homophobia, etc. And it's ironic that, you know, the one thing since the left have seemingly abandoned the working class, the one prejudice that is acceptable is to have a go at the chav, at the working class man. And ironically as well, the left seems to have basically abandoned the white working class almost to the BNP. I mean, they've almost handed them to the BNP on the plate.
Well, I mean, I think people, again, it's a kind of, it's not really talk about, BNP gets a lot of its support from middle class voters.
And ballet dancers.
And ballet dancers, yes. their tutus are fluttering rightwards. But, see, you're never going to win. This is why they hate Labour government. You know, this is why I talk about leftists without a left. You're never going to win power to get a political programme you agree on in, unless you can carry working class, lower middle class people with you.
Yeah.
Of course you're not. But then you see, you come back to my original point is, what is their political programme? What do they want? They don't want to do that. They're just, you know, they want this kind of purity and not making commitments, which, again, as I say, is very consumerist.
So, well, let's just carry on talking about the BNP then, because I sort of said that they've been abandoned to the BNP quite sort of facetiously, really, because that's an idea. There's an idea on the left as well that, you know,
the Labour Party hasn't abandoned the BNP.
No.
The trade unions are.
No, absolutely.
I'm talking about the liberal intelligentsia. I mean, actually, you still get a lot of very good people in the Labour Party fighting very good campaigns and in the trade union movement.
Well, I was just going to say that there is this idea that, you know, if you the white working class are almost, you know, we may as well not bother touching them because they will instinctively go and vote for somebody like the BNP, which clearly hasn't really happened on the scale that people think it has. So where do you think that sort of, you know, this idea comes from? Is that just...
I think there's a danger in multiculturalism. I'm not against multiculturalism. I believe in treating everyone in this country equally, regardless of colour, creed, or ethnicity. Of course I am. The danger of multiculturalism, when you push it into the extreme form, when you have parties like Respect, which are just a vehicle for Muslim rightist grievance, when you have Sikhs being able to close a play in Birmingham without one minister uttering a squeak of protest, the danger is that people will start, working class people, start thinking themselves as the whites, you know, and start competing for resources. I mean, I know Dagenham is where BNP has some success at the last local elections. Well, I've had officials in Dagenham who deal with grants and aid say, look, it's just ridiculous what's happened. According to our rules, 80% of our, sometimes it's looking at different budgets, but up to 80% of our money can be going to black groups, Muslim groups, blah, blah, blah. This is 75% white working class. They're not getting nothing. Well, you know, sooner or later, racist politicians will come to, well, let's organise you as the whites.
Yeah.
That's a huge danger of abandoning universal service, universal standards, and saying different rules apply to different cultures as if they're all set in aspic. Is that will happen? Because, well, you know, why not? If there's a black cancer group, cancer's cancer, you know, why not have a white cancer group, you know? It's that's the logic of multiculturalism is a kind of far right white politics.
Okay, well let's there's a chapter in the book where you discuss the impact of the sort of conspiracy theory mindset on various groups, and we would have thought a few years ago we would have thought that the conspiracy mindset was something was like a right wing thing, a right wing American thing typically. They were against this idea of, you know, they thought the UN was flying over in black helicopters to take over, but it seems like large parts of the left have taken up this conspiracy theory idea as well now, and I wonder if this is another symptom of, you know, the death of socialism, basically, that they're basically grasping for anything to be, you know, almost the sort of, you know, when you stop believing in God, you believe in anything type.
Well, it is, although I do say, when I'm giving old Noam Chomsky a bit of a kicking, that, you see, Marxism quickly develops into conspiracy theory. The first generation of Marxists, after Marx's death, are faced with the rather awkward problem that the working class have not risen up, as he predicted. And so they develop the false consciousness conspiracy theory. They say, aha, it's not that Marx was wrong. Heaven forfend, dear me, couldn't be. That he's already being treated as a sacred figure. It's that the media society is brainwashing, a conspiracy of media owners is brainwashing the workers so they can't see their real interests. Now that sounds harmless enough as conspiracy theory, but that has led to some of the most terrible crimes of the 20th century. Because the Bolsheviks can justify seizing power in the Russian Revolution by saying, well, actually, the workers don't know their own interests. We do, because we're intellectuals, so we're not brainwashed. We're far too clever for the sun, you know, and seize power. And that view of the hegemonic, to start slipping into Gramscian and postmodern jargon, brainwashing people against their own interests, runs right the way through. From Engels, through Lenin, through the postmodernists, into Chomsky, and it's all a conspiracy theory. And you see it in every day, you know. Every day you hear people saying, you know, it was a sum what won the 1992 election, or whatever, it wasn't at all. This idea that the intellectual, that there was a conspiracy brainwashing the masses, and the intellectuals, normally French intellectuals these days, only they are clever enough to see through it, is very commonplace. I'm just amazed. I had this book out. I put my email, not my email address, I've got a little website, I just bung my stuff on. And I put my website address on it. You go on there, you go on the email. And what's interesting, cause people accuse me of going off to the right and all kinds of stuff, is I'm having hundreds of emails now. Overwhelmingly, they're from liberal-minded, left-minded people who realise that something's going very badly wrong, which is very encouraging. I always reply to them. But the real attacks I've had have been from me just looking at Bosnia and saying, well, Bosnian the concentration camps of Bosnian Muslims actually existed. And there's a massive network of nutters out there denying the Bosnian concentration camps in the same terms and with the same tactics as neo-Nazis deny the Nazi concentration camps. And this is a huge, huge, huge industry. Yeah. And the reason for it is led by the Revolutionary Communist Party in Britain, who are all over the media. And the reason for it is this, is if you think that your own society, Western democracy, is just hopelessly corrupt. It's a sham. It's the playthings of the corporations who are conspiring. All the Jews, increasingly, the Jews are all the neocons, as they like to call them now. The Zionists are controlling corporations, American foreign policy. You can't admit any good of their society. So when Western forces intervene in Bosnia and Kosovo, that has to be a conspiracy too. And you have to say, well, the media invented those concentration camps to justify an imperialist assault on the Balkans.
As an aside, I mean, I'm sure you're surprised by the amount of Bosnian conspiracy theories, but at where I worked the other week, after Hrant Dink was killed, we put up an article about him and the Armenian genocide.
Uh-huh.
And almost immediately got this, and it's a similar tactics. I mean, I'm kind of looked and thought, what we have here is a David Irving of the Armenian genocide. This is the exact same tactic of ridiculous amount of documents.
Yeah.
With very selective quoting all the whole time. But I was amazed. I just didn't realise, well, beyond the Turkish government, but there was a real movement that went on.
Yeah, but I mean,
websites,
you know, the screamers, I guess, about Bosnia and Herzegovina. Because I do accept her on denial. I turn this around, Chomsky. And you might say, well, Nick, why are you going off into that? But denial is very important. Because it might not matter what the RCP and all their friends and the BBC and the Times think. But it does matter. People deny because they want to do it again. Why do European fascists deny the Holocaust? Because the millions of dead of the Second World War might seem to have given their lives in vain. They might seem to have died because of an insane ideology. But they didn't. They stopped fascism. Because after the war, every time when Europeans wanted to turn to fascism, they were confronted by the image of Auschwitz, the gates at Auschwitz. So they could, you know, that put them off. So if you want to get fascism back, you have to deny. Similarly with Serb nationalism.
Yeah.
Extreme Serb nationalism, not decent. Similarly with Serb nationalism. If you want to ethnically cleanse the Balkans again, you have to get people to deny what happened before. That makes it a bit easier for you. And with the internet, of course, this stuff just gets all over the place. It's extraordinary. You type in the name of the Trongsepol camp.
Sorry?
The Trongsepol camp in Prijedor in northeast Bosnia. You get thousands of hits. All saying it never existed, it was just a stunt by journalists, you know, to justify an imperial attack on Slobodan Milosevic. So it does matter, and I start this book with a wonderful quote from a great historian of fascism in the 20th century called Norman Cohn. And he says, it is a great mistake to suppose that the only writers who matter are those whom the educated in their saner moments can take seriously. There exists a subterranean world where pathological fantasies disguised as ideas are churned out by crooks and half-educated fanatics. There are times when this underworld emerges from the depths and suddenly fascinates, captures and dominates multitudes of usually sane and responsible people. Well, you know, that does happen. And
he could be describing the internet.
Sorry?
He could be describing the internet.
You need to fight this. You need to take this on. And you need to not let the liberals off the hook. Because a lot of this is imbued by them. You know, the totalitarian conspiracy theory of democracy is, as I mentioned before, democracy, human rights, women's rights, gay rights, it's all worthless. It's all a sham. And the real movers and shakers are the corporations, the bourgeoisie, the Jews, you take your pick, depending on your totalitarian movement. Now, actually, if I go to an Islington dinner party, and I were to say that, I would say, oh yeah. Right on. You know, that's everywhere. Those ideas are everywhere. You can't just parcel things up and say, well, that's just the far left and that's the far right. You know, it's you need to stand up for the best of your country, for our freedoms, for our democracy, against people who are quite prepared to damage it, and a lot of very silly people who are just fellow travelling with them.
Well, one of the sort of the big conspiracy theory that's doing the rounds at the moment is this old. Well, there's a lot, but they're all to do with basically 9/11 and you know the official reporting to 9/11 and we're not being told the truth, and there's various different groups and levels of craziness involved. But this happened. It seemed to happen almost immediately, as soon as you know, the towers went down. They came out, and even. For instance, David Shaler, who himself has a show on this station, is convinced that there were holograms that flew into the buildings rather than planes. I mean, I wonder where do you think this?
Well, the ideological motivation is this: because they hate America more than anything else, they can't accept as any they can't say anything in favour of America, such as you suffered terrible casualties on 11th of September 2001. So they have to pretend that's all invention by. The evil Bush or what have you. Poor old David Shaler, dear me. I used to take stories from him. I absolutely believed him. And now he's going on about holograms. And all that. I saw him at a party and I said, David, you've gone completely mad, haven't you? He said, no, it's all true, holograms. And I said, do you believe the world's secretly governed by giant lizards? And he said no, but he paused just a second too long before saying it. I mean, I don't know, but the appeal of conspiracy theory is a great appeal. It also appeals to the defeated. If you're in the friends of mine who work in Moscow after the fall of the Soviet Union, they said there were conspiracy theories everywhere.
Yeah.
Because we've been this great power, this superpower, and it's gone.
Well, this is the case.
There must be a conspiracy theory. And you see, in a sense, the left's been defeated. You know, or they think they have. They can't see what they've won, and they can't see their honourable struggles for them to engage in. And so, trying to explain, you know, why it is that no one ever votes for them, or you know, liberal intellectuals trying to who think they're on the side of the people, trying to explain why the people don't go with them. If you lose your bearings a bit, if you lose your intellectual rigour, you can very easily start falling conspiracy theories. Oh, it's all the Murdoch press. You know, it's all the neocons.
Well, it's comforting to think that the world's controlled by forces that you cannot control, because it somehow makes your life
very more
simpler, understandable.
Yes.
Yeah.
The fact the world's a mess is a far harder one to get your mind around.
Do you think there's also? I mean, I find when occasionally I decide to read these things, God knows why, you always find that the argument comes up. It's ridiculous that some guy in a cave in Afghanistan. It's a very thinly veiled racism towards Arabs or people from the Middle East and Southeast Asia in general. Uh-huh. They couldn't do it because, really, they're only Arabs.
Yeah, but
the only people who are actually capable of doing this are the mighty American government, the overseeing. Right.
But this is
it's also a way of denying Islamism. I mean, it's Adam Curtis, BBC Films, the absolute classic on this. They're not seeing this as a movement that has its first success with the Iranian Revolution. Yeah, an epoch-making revolution which has sent out massive reverberations and is still doing so today, and seeing global movements, not one united global movement, but the Brotherhood, Jamaat-e Islami. Yeah, there's Islamist violence going on everywhere from the Philippines to Canada. You know, it's what do you mean they can't do that? You know, they've got an ideology. They've got a lot of money coming out of Saudi Arabia. They've got bases. Do quite a bit, you know. But most of all, they're going to do it to their fellow Muslims, who ought to be able to turn to Europe, the home of democracy and liberalism and feminism and socialism, and ask for people who call themselves left-wing for their support. That's the most shameful thing that's going on.
Yeah,
you know, this is a book about betrayal and refusal to commit. It's not a book particularly. The Iraq War gets me going on that. It's not a book about what's happening in Iraq. It's a book about what has happened to rich people. And why can't they commit to people who share their values? And again, the conspiracy theory is a bit of a help there, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. You dedicate the book to, we said before that socialism as a project, at least in Europe, is dead, and you dedicate the book to Hadi Saleh, and he describes the last of the socialists. Do you really think that there is no redeeming element that will happen, socialism, and if not, what do we do instead?
Well, no, I mean, this is a book that essentially, there's a chapter on the 30s, is a narrative that runs from 1968 through to the present. By the 90s, it is quite clear, even to people like me who don't want to, that socialism has gone. Now, I'm not a prophet, I'm not Mystic Meg, I can't see the future. I think, I certainly hope that sensible, practical left-wing policies start to revive. I think climate change will necessitate an awful lot of cooperative and altruistic policies. But as with climate change, the first task is to clear away the denial. The other great crisis of our time is radical Islam. What I'm trying to do is just clear away the denial on that, and so people can see clearly. I'm just trying to shake people up a bit and get to see the world a bit more clearly. And then, actually, if you do that, if you stop making excuses for the far right, you might start to get a better left as well.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll have to leave it there. We're quickly running out of time. So we've been talking about Nick's book, What's Left? How the Liberals Lost Their Way, and this is published by Fourth Estate, and it's a absolutely rollicking read, so you should definitely get hold of one. Nick, thanks very much for coming into Little Atoms again.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back Podrag and Richard will be back in 2 weeks' time.